This is an ABC podcast.
What is it that makes a child's mind tick? What are the things that influence a young person to think in a particular way and remain very focused, sometimes in pretty creative ways, on things that are frankly bizarre? And what happens to those kids when they grow up? Peter Hellyer is a comedian. As a child, he was, for a time, captivated by the idea of death and wrote about it endlessly. There was even a time he staged a play about the murder of game show host Larry Emder. But we'll get to that. Peter Hellyer, welcome.
Thank you, Hamish. And can I just say, Larry Emder is still alive and well. It was the fictitious death of Larry Emder.
I can't wait to get to that part of this conversation. Why were you so often found writing stories as a kid?
I think the first way I came to stories, I think, was the biblical stories. I was raised a Catholic, and so we went to church every week at 7:30 mass. That would go for, depending on if our parish priest barracked for Carlton in the then VFL. So if Carlton won, the mass would go shorter, so he could go home and watch the replay. And if they lost, the mass went a bit longer. So we did that. We went home, and we got our two blocks of Cadbury chocolate. We went to home to watch probably the Man for Snow River or the movies of the like. And so, you know, church was a big part of my life, as was, Catholicism. I went to a Catholic primary school and high school. And, yeah, biblical. I was just fascinated with biblical stories.
Did you have a favourite Bible story?
Daniel and the Lion's Den was one that, you know, caught my imagination, and David and Goliath. And then they became, for me, the more I questioned Catholicism and these stories, they became, I kind of saw the humour in them as I think, began to struggle a little bit with the whole concept.
And you had a love for paper and pens as well.
Yeah, I was always in my bedroom with a paper and pen. And in fact, during those awkward teenage years, I would often be in my bedroom with a paper and pen. And if I've said before, if Mum and Dad came in, I'd rather have been caught doing myself a favour than actually being caught writing. There was something I found quite, at times, embarrassing. It depends on what I was writing. If I was just drawing and making up silly stories, it'd be fine. But sometimes, you know, when you push into the more angsty Alanis Morissette years, I was really kind of laying myself out there a little bit more. And sometimes I'd be writing lyrics, which I think was poetry, but just, you know, I kind of shaped it as being lyrics, because lyrics sounds cooler than poetry. But I'd come up with like fictitious bands, and I'd have these like album titles and song titles for a band called the Jacobins, which were like the first, I think, political party in the world that I'd read in France and, you know, whenever. And so I thought that sounded pretty cool. So I would write these kind of lyrics, and then if somebody came in, I'd quickly shove them in a drawer or under, you know, a silly picture of something.
Where was the angst coming from?
It's a good question, because I have no, well, you know, every kid has reasons to be angsty. Growing up is tricky. It's a minefield to navigate, and I was no exception. But I had a very good, when people talk about, you know, white privilege, I'm it, you know, like I get that. My parents are still alive and they're still together. There's never really been any hint of them separating that I've been aware of. I'm close with my siblings, an older brother, an older sister, a younger sister. We're very close. We see each other a lot. I grew up in middle class Bundura in the Melbourne's north, red brick house. It was white bread, footy, cricket. You know, it was Atari. You know, it was all those. We had all those things. So, yeah, where does the angst come from? I don't know. Just, trying to find my place. I lost a cousin when I was 8 years old, and that kind of threw me a little bit for quite a while. That was probably a fair cause of my angst.
Tell me about the day you got the news your cousin had died.
So Matthew was, he was about 6 months older than me. We were both eight. And he had had a couple of years of leukemia. And I remember being at the dinner table, and my mum hadn't come home from work. She used to work at the bank, and Dad was home, which was kind of slightly strange, and kind of organising dinner, you know, badly, you know, burning ham steaks. And so this knew that something was up. Our antennas were up. And then I remember looking out and seeing the lights of the car, mum's car, up the driveway, and then her getting out of the car. Our dining table was right next to our window that led out to the driveway. And I saw mum get out, and then I saw somebody else get out of the car. And it was my auntie, Mary, and they were both, I could hear them both kind of crying and upset. And I just knew then Matt had leukemia for a couple of years by then. And, I remember them coming in and just telling us, and me running off to my bedroom and burying my face in the pillow and just bawling. And and my siblings trying, rubbing my back, trying to, comfort me, because I was the closest to Matt. And, just really wanting to be alone.
How close to Matt were you?
My siblings always all had cousins of similar ages. So they always, whenever we had functions, whether it be Christmas or just birthday parties, get-togethers, they would always have their friends and such cousins to hang with and be, age-appropriate with them, whereas I was either playing with kids younger, or like almost toddlers or 12, 13-year-olds at the time who didn't really want an 8-year-old hanging out with them. So that was tricky. But so Matt was my mate, and we would, we shared an interest in Lego. And I remember I have flashes of days, before he got sick, like a skateboarding. It's the only time I can remember skateboarding, because I was no good at that. So I think I would have been like not actually standing up skateboarding. I think I would have been like on my bum kind of skateboarding, maybe going down, the hill of the crest of the top of the road, and just, riding some bikes and doing that stuff. So I have very kind of like flashy kind of not complete kind of memories of him, to be honest.
And how did that experience start to affect the things you're writing in your stories?
Yeah, it's funny when you look back at them as an adult, and there's a lot of my stories they show a boy with a very healthy ego. I'm doing things like playing in the NBA and winning games with Michael Jordan. I'm beating Hulk Hogan in a WWF wrestling match in one of them. There's two books called Me the Sports Star, and I win the Davis Cup for Australia by serving a hand grenade to Stefan Edberg. and there's a story where I'm Indiana Hallier and we're going off for adventures with my classmates. And then there's one little gem of a book called Buried Alive, and I don't know what was going on in my head and when I wrote this book. And it's about a boy who his name's Colin Nigel McNerd, and he ends up getting buried alive, basically. And at first, when I read it as an adult, after not reading it for years, I was like, oh, this must be a story about how he redeems himself and, he rises to the top. We see the underdog rise, and it's not really. It's about an underdog who not only doesn't rise, he actually buries himself alive. And only as an adult and recently, I'm pretty sure it's connected. If I was to psychoanalyze myself and indulge in a bit of psychobabble, then I would potentially say this was me at this age trying to get closer to my cousin who had passed away. I was pretty fascinated and about death for a while, and had a lot of questions that probably didn't really get answered, to be honest. I didn't really know who to, because everybody was grieving. That's the thing. When you lose an 8-year-old in the family to leukemia, everyone's, I didn't think I was any, I needed any special attention outside of, I knew mum was upset. I knew my siblings were upset. I knew my grandparents were upset. My uncle and auntie and their kids were upset. So, I felt like, okay, well, if I keep things to myself, I won't bother anyone. So I think it came out in some of my writing. And even when I got to high school, and a lot of it was about death, and that's when I started, I remember one title was like Falling Off the Rocking Horse. It was kind of like, it had death. Even one of my more fun kind of stories, which was called The King's Quest, which was a sequel to the Indiana Jones story that I wrote. And all my friends wanted to be involved because I got to read these stories in front of the class. And so a lot of my classmates said, oh, can we be in the next one? There was like demand to be in the next one. So I tried to get like a dozen of my classmates into the next one. But I didn't have the skills as a writer to juggle that many characters. So in the last page, pretty much everyone just gets killed. Everyone dies. And it was obviously a very confronting and controversial read for my classmates in class 5K.
There was a pretty unusual thing your family did in farewelling Matt. And I wonder how much that impacted you, even if just visually.
Yeah, I remember going over to Matt's house, the family house, and walking into the lounge room, and Matt was just there on the coffee table, just with a sheet, and I assume he had maybe a pillow for his head, but he was gone, and there's everybody standing around, and then somebody saying to me, I think it was Matt's mother saying, go and give him a kiss, kiss goodbye, and I was just, it was very, it was nice in a way, but it was also, I'm kind of in hindsight, I'm kind of glad I had that experience, but I remember thinking at the time, I feel like everybody's looking at me, and I've never seen a dead body before. And he was, he was gone. He was cold and white and dry. And so I just gave him a kiss on the cheek. And yeah, and that was, that probably also helped along my obsession with death, I think. Yeah.
It's a strange thing to even hear you describe today.
I'm not, at the time I wasn't sure if that was a common thing. I still don't know how common that is. It was how the family were dealing with it. And, I respected that, I guess, enough. And again, I didn't ask because I knew everyone was going through this thing, this horrible, horrible thing that we knew was coming. But, nothing prepares you.
Does it strike you now that maybe while most of the family were struggling to deal with this, you actually had an outlet in your books, the stories that you wrote?
Oh, I've got no doubt that writing has been the single biggest thing in my life. It's a message I guess I try to get across, even when I'm just talking to school groups, is that just write. Just, write about your good days and write about your bad days because it'll make you feel better. And I had an experience which was a way less tragic experience, but it was had a bit of an epiphany when a few years later I went to the football with my father, who took me to a Collingwood game at Victoria Park, which we did most weeks, and I wanted to go get a hot dog, and he didn't want me to go get it because the game had started, so he didn't want me to go get this hot dog. So he gave me the money, and it was like the first bit of freedom I'd ever received. I was very excited. I was like, wow, a hot dog. This is, I can go get it by myself, and this is great. In the end, to cut a story short, I turn around after putting my sauce on the hot dog, and a man standing right behind me, and I hit his elbow. The hot dog comes loose, and it falls to the ground, and I just leave it there because I wasn't aware of the 3-second rule back then. And I went back and I was really upset by it and the injustice because the man didn't say, oh, I'll get you a new one, or the man selling the hot dogs didn't do anything. So I went back empty-handed with no money and no hot dog. And it wasn't until I was dry, I was in the car on the way home that I had this thought. And I remember having it. And this is the one thing that turned my kind of, if you like, frown upside down, which was, I'm going to go to school on Monday. I'm going to write a story about this. And I wrote the first autobiographical story I'd ever written, and I saw that I could take something from my life and make it funny. And I remember the kids in the class particularly thought that story was hilarious. And I thought, okay, you can share your, in inverted commas, pain about something as trivial as losing a hot dog and make people laugh, whether it be, through jokes or stories. That was a big kind of a weird big moment for me.
The incredible thing is that your mother has saved all of these books, or at least some of them. You've brought a pile of them in today. Can you just describe them?
Yeah. So what I would do is I would write the stories, sometimes during class, but sometimes in my own time. And then I would give them to the teacher. She would type them up, and then I would make a cover for all of them. So they're all different colors. We have a yellow, a green, an orange, a brown, and staple them together. There's some pretty handy bubble writing, I think, as you can see, Hamish. There's some nice shading on one of them. There's some motifs. Meet a Sports Star has a nice star motif going through it. There's a bit of an 80s look to that one. And each of them, apart from one, one of the first ones has a logo called Better Books, and that was the publishing company that I founded, my very own publishing company, Better Books. And they all have that logo, it's two Bs in squares with the Better Books running vertically underneath.
And the Buried Alive cover is a lovely sunflower yellow.
It is. See, it would be too obvious if I went black, black with one of those silver pens perhaps. But yeah, so that, and I remember reading them out in class, and, and this may completely be in my head, but I always thought there was a bit of some buzz around whenever there was a new Better Books to be read aloud. And my classmates always reacted really positively. They found them funny. Yeah, I kind of got a sense of also performing, I guess.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Hamish McDonald. Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app.
How did your writing evolve once you got to high school?
Well, it became certainly more angsty. I do remember one moment in high school where I wrote this quite angsty story, which I mentioned before, falling off the rocking horse, which is about six mates at a funeral. Surprise, surprise. It ends with the revelation that one of them had actually killed the guy, one of the mates. And then that's just the end of it. So there's no follow-up or it's a bit of a head scratcher at the end. And the teacher said it was well written, but she said, you have a wonderful sense of humor and I think you should use it more in your writing. And I took exception to it because I had stuff I wanted to say and express that I didn't think was funny. And I was aware that I had a sense of humor, but I thought there's times I want to use my sense of humor and other times where I don't. And this, you know, if I want to write something that's from other parts of my imagination or heart or soul, then I should be allowed to do that. So I kind of, the next three or four essays I wrote were always very serious. And I used to write, if I had particularly a creative essay, not necessarily like an analytical one, but if I had a creative essay I had to write for English, I would write two or three different stories and then hand the best one in. And I loved it.
Tell me about the time you killed off Larry Emder.
Apologies to Larry, who I've become very good friends with.
Does he know about this?
I'm sure I've told him. If not, if you're hearing this for the first time, Larry, I do apologise, and I'll give me a call, please. So I wrote. Well, first of all, I'd written a just off my own bat for my own fun. I wrote a sketch show, a live show that we performed at lunchtime. We had a beautiful theatreette that I remember my brother, who was 4 years older than me, in year seven they would have drama night, and I went to his drama night in year seven and saw this theatreette, and I just fell in love with this space. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I couldn't wait to get to that school. I'm at the Parade College in Bundoora, and I couldn't wait to get the Parade just so I could be in that theatreette, to be honest. And I wrote this sketch show tied up in an English kind of assignment that I had to do. You could do anything. You could write an essay, but I chose to do a whole production, which is more work than probably anyone did for their thing. And it was called Tuesday. I played a guy called Detective Tuesday, who was hired to solve the crime of all the game show hosts were being murdered. So it wasn't just Larry Emder. It was like Greg Evans and a few of the big game show hosts
like
at the
Tony
time.
Tony Barber?
Tony Barber was in there, yes. He got it as well. He got one in the neck. Apologies to Tony. And Rob Ruff, I think, might have been there as well. And supposedly in this world, nobody wanted the crime solved. So they found the worst detective in the world, which was Detective Tuesday. And because we were an all-boys school, Christian Brothers school, we had no girls there. We didn't even have access to wigs. So when we did a blind date / perfect match kind of parody for the Greg Evans bit, we said, well, we have no girls, we have no wigs, so we just made it a gay version of Perfect Match or Blind Date, which, you know, the kids found the huge big laughs, in the auditorium. The principal of our Christian Brothers school did not find it as entertaining, and we got called in to the office a couple of days later. I think the principal wasn't there, but once he'd heard about it, he called us in, and he was pretty ropeable, and he demanded that we give them the tape, the VHS tape, because we had recorded it, and we just hid that tape. We just said, we haven't got it. We taped over it, as you would. Just did this big production that went really well, and then tape over it with Family Ties a few days later. So we...
This is pretty progressive. What year are we talking?
This is year 10. And then their parents were called in, and I remember my best mate's dad saying, I don't know why you're looking to punish these kids so much. They've put an enormous amount of work into this. Sure, their humor may have slid off, you know, into different areas than what you know. So I can understand maybe, you know, a warning, but not yeah, they were talking expulsion. They were talking, you know, all kinds of things. So
for a gay version of Blind Date.
For a gay version of Blind Date, how far we've come. And, you know, like, I don't remember. I actually don't remember any of the jokes are in there. They probably wouldn't stand up to today's standards either, to be honest. But we were, you know, we were 15 and having some fun.
What do you think the teachers at the school expected you to go on to do?
It's funny. There was a moment where a classmate, because I got in trouble again, I just started the student newspaper with two friends, Neil Sharkey and Mark Farrell. Hey, guys, if you're listening. And it was called the Old Pile, because the first lines of the parade song was Old Bluestone Pile, because it was made from old bluestone. And so we were the newspaper was the Old Pile, and we had a very supportive teacher in Mr. Natoli, who was married to Mrs. Natoli at the school, and she was also very supportive of me. And we lasted about three editions. The Old Pile was shut down. was shut down. And then one of my classmates, Elliot Smale, I do remember, and I still appreciate Elliot doing this. He stood up in the classroom and he said, "Do you ever consider that this is actually what Pete's good at, and he actually might go on and do something in this area?" And the teacher kind of scoffed, and so I that kind of put a rocket up my bum a little bit, and kind of thought, okay, I'm gonna go hell for leather for this.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Hamish McDonald on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Peter Hellyer, what was your first gig in TV?
My first gig was a writing gig. I got into stand-up comedy in 1996, and it was my. I think I had a plan to do it for a year, or might have been 2 years, and to try to get a TV gig, a writing gig, and then eventually kind of meet some contacts in the film world to make it, maybe get some films made. It was kind of a reasonably naive plan, but that was where my head was at. And within 6 months, I got a writing gig for a show called Totally Full Frontal, which was on Channel 10, which was a spin-off from the Full Frontal show that was very successful on Channel 7 with Eric Banner and those guys. And I lasted there for about 6 weeks because it was a strange system that they had. It was, I think most writers now, I'm not sure if this even system exists anymore in any writer's room anymore. It shouldn't. It's not a good system where you would basically write for minutes. So you had to, you'd be contracted to provide 2 minutes, you know, for the show. And then you had to get that 2 minutes. And if you got more than that, then you'd get paid more. But it meant that if somebody came up with an idea that could maybe spin off, obviously in those shows you see ideas where they kind of, you know, they do a lot of callbacks, or it's a character who, you know, they might bring you back 3 or 4 times during a show. Other people would jump on the idea and to boost their minutes. So it wasn't a great I mean, it was fun being a, you know, like having a real paying kind of professional TV job. That was cool. I enjoyed going in there, you know, with my briefcase and with the Herald Sun and the banana in it. but it was, and then I wrote a sketch. The reason I decided to leave because I wrote a sketch where it was just a locked off shot of like some professor looking dude in his office with heaps of books on his desk opened, and he's got books behind, huge grand bookcase behind him, and he's going through these books and he's trying to find something. He's getting really frustrated. He's trying to find a piece of writing. He can't find it. It goes on for about 30 seconds. And then I think he says something like, "Oh, if only I wasn't illiterate." And the joke being that he's, you know, why, what's this guy doing in this library almost? Everybody liked it, but then one of the head writers said to me, the feedback was that he didn't believe our audience would know what the word illiterate meant. So I decided to leave because I hate it when people say Like we did, radio on a commercial radio station, and Marlon Brando was part of a punchline or part of a sketch that we had. And our program director said, I just don't think our audience know who Marlon Brando is. And it's my reaction is always, well, they should. And if they don't, let's tell them. If I've ever been watching television or movies or reading and something I know or I don't know is in front of me, I ask somebody. I ask my dad or, I ask mom or I consulted back then, the Encyclopedia Britannica, you'd find out. So I hate this kind of notion that you have to try to please everyone.
Do you think audiences are underestimated too often?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, there's no doubt that you cannot possibly please everyone with your piece. You need to, if you had a musician in, there are obviously people who might tune in because they love that person's music. And then there's other people who might hate this musician and have no interest. So you might just lose them. But then there's this middle ground of people who maybe don't, they kind of know. I mean, I'm not sure if you're the same, but I'm like, I have no idea who this person is. And they play me the song. I say, oh, yeah, I know. I've heard this song. I like this song. Okay, cool. But all you can do is you get to try to maybe pique their interest and kind of go, okay. So they go away. Okay, now I know who that person is. I might investigate more and download some of their music, or I might not, but at least I know. At least I'm connecting with some kind of part of the pop cultural kind of spectrum, and if I'm at a barbecue on the weekend and, I know now that, Lord Jar Jar is the latest cool person on the charts. Now, charts probably don't exist anymore, and there's Lord Jar Jar, so don't go to your barbecue quoting that specific example.
What happens in a high-functioning writer's room?
It's writers' rooms are magical places. They're eating donuts. They're soft drink. Lots of caffeine and sugar. But it's funny because I think you need a reason to be in there to get it. It's like being on set when if you go to a film set or a TV set, they're great places to be if you're involved in the production and if you're working on it. But I think if you're just visiting. After about maybe 10 minutes, or maybe you've done a bit of star spotting, I guess that can be fun. But after that, you kind of feel like you're in the way and you shouldn't be there. And I think writers' rooms are like that. If you don't have a reason to be in there, you probably need to get out. I've been in other writers' rooms. We did a series, How to Stay Married, recently, and we did had a, some sessions recently, and we brought in more writers. And the first day, it was like, a lot of writers who just met each other, and I just met them, and I walked out after a while just kind of going, wow, there were moments in that day where there were like three or four jokes happening at the same time. Like, it was just like, it felt really lovely and the high energy, but, people wanting to impress on the first day and maybe being competitive, maybe not. And then we basically broke it up a little bit and had, worked out who worked well with who, and then kind of had like more sessions where we grouped different writers up together, and it was much better. So it's that kind of navigation, How to Stay Married. It's a date. It was, yeah, just being in there and I guess running it to a degree and making sure we move on when it's time to move on, or ideas don't get lost, because sometimes there could be an idea and then people go, oh, yeah, I don't quite understand that, but how about this happen? And you go down that, rabbit's warren for a bit, and then you kind of have to decide whether it's worth coming back to the other idea or worth progressing with that idea. So, yeah, it's fun.
There's so much machinery around comedy, but I wonder, do you still feel like a big kid?
Oh, sure. I feel like I am. I completely feel like I'm just connecting with the kid who wrote these stories, to be honest. I always have felt that, and I hope he's proud of who I've become. I think how I try to keep my head together and I had hopes and dreams and I've got to live a lot of those hopes and dreams, and I think I try to think if the 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old Peter Hallier met the 43-year-old version, would he be happy? Would he be, I think he probably would be.
Do you think you might be one of the world's happiest comedians?
Possibly. I mean, there's a lot of happy. We all get tarred by the same brush sometimes. Listen, there are certainly comedians who do have busy heads, And as I do, I might be in the top 10 or something. Yeah. I mean, he's happy, but he's happy when he's on stage, you know, I think. But I've just got no reason not to be happy. I mean, it would be ridiculous if I presented myself as a sad clown or angsty or disheartened. This is a really competitive business. I realize it's a long game. I have been employed since, really, we did the Rove pilot in, I think, the end of 98, or on air at 99, and I've been on air ever since, really. So through Rove Live and Skid House and Before the Game and The Project and It's a Date and How to Stay Married. And it's been an amazing career. There's been some stumbles along the way where you take on something that you don't quite get right. I look at anybody's career who I admire, and the people I admire the most in the industry are people like Sean McAuliffe and Tony Martin and those guys, and they've had the work they put out is incredible. But of course, they've had a couple of little stumbles. So, and they're good to have, you know, in hindsight. It's not good when you're going through it, but it's good to look back at your career and kind of go, okay, this is what I learned from there. And this is also who I met by doing these experiences. Sometimes a TV audience can look at the end product as what they see on screen, but it's what sometimes the experience of making that thing is just as good. And without dropping a name, but when I was fortunate enough to write a movie called I Love You Too, which I'm very proud of, and had Brennan Cowell, Yvonne Strahovski, who's gone on to The Handmaid's Tale, and Peter Dinklage, who it was the last project he did before he went off and did Game of Thrones. And I remember him saying to me, you know, like, you need to enjoy the production of the film, like the shooting, because this is the most fun time. And if you don't invest and engage in this, if you're putting your eggs in the basket of the box office and reviews, then that will not lead to happiness at all. You need to just enjoy this moment.
The way you make it sound, you are constantly working, but you're an incredibly committed dad and husband as well. How do you find the balance? How do you get it right?
Well, you're making an assumption that I get it right. I'm striving always for to get it right. I have a very supportive family. They know, certainly my wife knows, this is a long game. You know, I talk about it a bit. And, you know, I there are times when I will say I had plans to go home from the project, grab some dinner and write for a few hours. But I come home and my wife maybe has a glass of wine that she just poured for herself, and I think, okay, let's just have a night where we just, you know, have a couple of glasses of wine and catch up. And so being able to, you can't always do it because sometimes you're on deadline and there's a new, you know, Frankie Fish book due or something, and so you have to just keep going. But there, you know, when you get those opportunities to take a breath, you need to take your breath and hopefully involve your family in that. I mean, I don't really have a lot that I do outside of work. Going to the football is my one kind of release, you know, where I get to, you know, to go. But then I try to hang out with my kids, you know. My kids are getting older. My kids come to the football with me now. You know, the show that I did recently, my family came for the first time to see the show. So I try to involve them. We try to get away. They came to Adelaide with me for the show this year. They're coming to Canberra with me on Easter Saturday, Easter weekend. So, yeah, I try to involve them as much as I can.
Is family the greatest joy for you now?
Oh, absolutely. I kind of feel like I'm doing it all. I'm doing it all for the 11-year-old kid in his bedroom at Bundura and the three kids who are in my house right now. Like, they're the bookends in a way. And I completely feel like I'm doing, and that's why I started writing a kids series, because I wanted to have something that the kids could enjoy in the moment, you know, as they went out. And and that's been, you know, it's been awesome.
Do they find you funny?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think I've gotten away with, I'm not sure about being a cool dad, but I've gotten away with, you know, not being completely embarrassing. And that's where I think The Project is a good show to be on with kids, because a lot of their friends watch it, you know. And it's not, if I was still doing Rove Live, as much as, you know, we always had cool people coming through that show. But, you know, there were times where I was in a leotard, you know, you know, I was, you know, in drag, you know. So that may have, you know, got to the stage where, you know, where they may have found that a bit embarrassing. But where the project's a grown-up job.
Peter Hellyer, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, mate. I really appreciate it.
Pete's latest book, Frankie Fish and the Sister Chamozzle, is published by Hardy Grant. I'm Hamish McDonald. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.